It's better over here.
After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
Struggling with mental health shouldn't be the norm. At Mindful Therapy Group, we specialize in connecting you with compassionate therapists to find the perfect fit for you. Mindful Therapy Group accepts most health insurances. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com to start your mental health journey today.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Better Living, a show about people or organizations having a big impact here in North Texas. I'm your host, Chris Arnold of 105.3 The Fan. And joining us today is Texas Department of Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller. How are you doing, Commissioner Miller?
Well, I'm just dandy. Good to be with you today. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, for sure. We're so glad you're here because school is starting up again all over the state. And I understand there's this program that's the Texas Agriculture Commission. They're partnering with teaching children where foods come from. And I'm all about that. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, it started several years ago, right after I was first elected to the office of Texas Agriculture Commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
One of the duties I have is running the food nutrition programs for the federal government and the state. The largest of that is the school lunch program. So I'm responsible for 5 million school meals each day, mainly school lunch and school breakfast programs. So trying to get my head around this giant program, I would travel to the school districts and visit with the cafeteria workers and the nutritionists. And I would ask them, I say, how much local products are you serving our kids? And they say, well, we don't serve any. I said, my gosh, why not? They said, well, we don't know any farmers. We don't have time to go to the farmer's market. It's just easier for us to order it from Benny, Keith, or Cisco's. They cook it, flash freeze it. We get it and thaw it out and put it on that plastic tray.
Oh, man.
I said, that's the problem. What we have now is healthy trash cans instead of healthy kids. They're not eating it. So I set out to change that attitude, and I don't believe in mandates. I believe in good programs and using the carrot instead of the stick. So I set up a program that wasn't mandatory. It was all voluntary, and it started out just on Fridays. I challenged to have Farm Fresh Friday and have at least one local product on the menu, and in addition to that, have Meet the Farmer Friday. Whatever product that was, I encouraged them to have the farmer that supplied it come to the school and tell those kids how that product got on the plate. So we started there. It was kind of slow. We've grown it from there. It's been great. So we've been doing this now for almost 9 years or 8 years, I guess. And last year, where our schools had been buying zero local products, they bought $300 million worth of locally grown products and served our children. The good news about that is, a lot of it's organic, no added dyes, no preservatives, never flash frozen. It's cooked fresh from scratch, and the kids eat it. And I like to say we're getting a threefer on that. Number one is the kids get some good, healthy, fresh, locally grown products. Number two, they farmers have an extra market where they can get a little premium, yet the schools get a good bargain price on it. And three, the taxpayers win. Those are tax dollars aren't going in the trash can and being thrown away. So we really like the program. It's been a huge success. We don't have it just in our schools, though. We do also this, encourage it in our child and adult care centers. We do it in our summer feeding programs. In addition to our Farm Fresh Network, we've sent out gardening kits to the lower grades, let them grow their own vegetables, have a little garden, get some dirt under fingernails, and they figure out where their food comes from. We have kind of become the model for the rest of the nation on getting this farm to school program. Texas Farm Fresh program has done that. We were really challenged in COVID. I'm responsible for 5 million school meals each day, so I had to go from feeding them in the lunchroom one day to figure out how to feed them at home. So we successfully did that. We came up with a home delivered meals program and again became the model for the rest of the nation. So we have a large conference in the summer called MegaCon. That's something started under my administration. We have the nutritionists, cafeteria workers. We have all the farmers that want to sell directly to our schools, come to Austin for about 3 days, and we link all of those up. I would encourage people that are interested in this program or maybe having it at your school or a farmer that wants to be part of it, go to our Farm Fresh website, and you can join the Farm Fresh network. There's a map there of Texas farms that are you know, available for schools to purchase from. There's also resources there for Texas Farm Fresh Network members, both schools and the farmers. So we kind of set up a clearinghouse. There's some great testimonials there by people that have been involved in our program, schools and farmers alike. So that's it. It's our Farm Fresh Network. Google that. Should pop up. You can also find it under our website, squaremeals.org, squaremeals.org.
This is absolutely fantastic, Commissioner Miller. I like the fact Texas Foods on students' trays, supporting Texas agriculture. You mentioned it's a win-win-win on three different levels. And I actually like the fact that you were able to, as a lot of businesses like to say, they made the pivot during the pandemic. I remember a lot of different grocery stores and different businesses were having supply chain issues. Can you talk about exactly what you were able to get done? Because you mentioned that you actually had to take some of these foods to the kids who are learning virtually. But more importantly, you had to overcome the supply chain issues.
We did. We actually set up a site called Direct from Texas, mainly on Facebook. And it was also a clearinghouse where housewives, schools could go on that. And our farmers would post what kind of products they had. You know, even some bartering went on, but mm-hmm. you could go in there and buy half a beef or farm-raised, you know, eggs, things like that. Fresh vegetables that were coming off would be posted on there. So it kind of became a very popular site, Direct from Texas. People got real concerned about where their food was coming from, and a lot of people kind of went back to the basics and started, you know, maybe having some backyard chickens or planting some fruit trees. So, and we do that. This has been a great program. You know, we consider anything grown in Texas local. So you may have a ruby red grapefruit on your plate. It may have traveled 200 or 300 miles, but we consider that local because it is a Texas product.
That is fantastic. And it's all about the farm to school movement. Can you talk about how robust this movement is now? Because again, I think sometimes going through a pandemic and people paying attention to what their kids are eating makes people more interested in all of these different ways that the state of Texas has all these different kind of foods to put on the plates for the schools.
And we're a very diverse state. So like yeah. I mentioned, we grow citrus in the valley, but we also grow fresh broccoli and cabbage and cauliflower. And we have tomatoes and, of course, cantaloupes and watermelons. So just about, depending on what part of the state you're in, maybe East Texas, we grow tomatoes and sweet potatoes and panhandle Irish potatoes fresh sweet corn and, you know, pumpkins. So we kind of got a large enough state with a diverse enough agriculture palette that we can deliver just about anything local. We don't do bananas, mangoes, or avocados, but other than that, we pretty much got them covered.
Actually, love it. I love this. And we're honored to have Texas Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller joining us this morning. And Commissioner Miller, I know it's not easy getting these things done without dollars. And I understand that the movement has gotten about $22.3 million in grant funds. How are you able to negotiate and navigate that? Because I know that could be tricky. You got to write up for those grants.
Well, you know, we're all going through a rising cost of gas and groceries, and that includes our schools. Mm-hmm. The money they get to run the school lunch programs is pretty static. So I reached out to the USDA, was able to draw down grant money, and you gave an amount of about $22, $23 million. And so we got that out to our schools. It kind of helped them ease their budget. But the one thing that they had to agree to is buy local products.
There you go.
So in addition to the $300 million that they were already buying local products, we were able to help them take the sting out of the rising cost of their grocery bill.
And last October, You started this thing called the Farm Fresh Challenge. Can you explain what that is and why a lot of schools and kids and child care centers were all inspired to start serving more Texas products?
Well, again, and I'll reiterate, my program's voluntary. I mean, mm-hmm. no one has to do it. We don't mandate it. So we want, again, it's to raise awareness, to make these child care centers, adult care centers, our summer feeding programs, and our schools aware of the program and get them to join the Farm Fresh Network. That actually parents drive it more than anything else. They will hear of a school where the lunchroom is great again. We're trying to, that's our goal, is make the lunchroom great again. And when they hear about it, they want the same thing in their cafeteria for their school. So they, you know, approach the school board and demand it. And then, of course, it's parent driven mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, by the kids being able to have good, healthy, wholesome, fresh, tasty meals in the lunchroom. We truly are trying to make the lunchroom great again. And I think we're getting there.
I think you are. In fact, the participants last year, they spent $13.8 million on Texas food products, an increase of 31.5% from 2022. And it reached over 2.5 million students at 3,615 sites across Texas. That's called getting it done. And I know that's probably not as much as you'd even want it to be done. I think you probably want even more.
Well, we're still growing the program. We have somewhere between 50 and 60% of the school campuses participating on a voluntary basis. But we're still growing it. We want everybody to have that opportunity. Of course, I believe in local control. Mm-hmm. It's a local decision whether they participate or not. Of course, we encourage them and give them incentives like, you know, the money I drew down to help them buy local produce and local products. So that helps. We're getting there. We're kind of at the tipping point. It was slow to start, you know, getting anybody to change what they've been doing is always a tough one. But we've kind of got to the tipping point where we don't have to settle as much now as it is demanded. So we're at a very good place getting local products in our schools.
You know, you say you came up with this about 9 years ago, well before anything like a pandemic would ever hit. It's almost like if we weren't, talk about Texas, if we weren't prepared for the situation, who knows what it would have been like about four years ago.
Well, in addition, you know, I mentioned that we run all of the nutrition programs, state and federal. We're also in charge of our mission. It is part of emergency management. Okay. So when we have a disaster like a hurricane down on the coast, and we have to put people up in shelters,
mm-hmm.
My department that, you know, supplies those USDA commodities, make sure that those people are fed too. A lot of people don't realize that. So our nutrition program is not just limited to, you know, to schools and nursing homes and summer feeding programs, but also emergency management. And we have a far reach when it comes to providing nutrition. My goal is that no Texan go hungry. And unfortunately, haven't reached that goal yet. We still do have some families and children that still need our help. But we're going to try to provide that.
You know what? You seem like the perfect guy for the job. Sometimes jobs are jobs, and other times jobs are careers. It's like this is what you're meant to do. Do you kind of feel that way? Because I'm telling you, you seem to have been getting a lot of stuff done, and you actually enjoy what you're doing.
Well, somebody asked me the other day, said, man, this year in your third term, when are you going to retire? I said, well, I guess I am retired. I'm doing exactly what I want. I love what I'm doing. Why would I retire? What would I do?
Yeah.
I can do it. I enjoy more. So I really do enjoy what I'm doing. I've been told with, you know, my team's doing a good job, and I'll back them up on that.
Yeah, I know you got a great team. Like you said, third term in the job. Can you talk about where you started personally? Did you spend a lot of time on a farm or a ranch growing up? Tell us a little bit about you.
Well, I'm an eighth generation farmer and rancher. My family started in 1700.
Look out.
And the last four generations have been here in Texas farming and ranching. And I grew up here in Central Texas on a farm and ranch, and graduate of Tarleton State University. I had a degree in vocational agriculture. So when I got out, I was actually an ag teacher. I taught agriculture to high school students. So I learned real quick that the greatest, as being an FFA advisor and 4-H leader, I learned real quick that our greatest natural resource we have in Texas is our youth. It's not oil and gas. So we put a big emphasis on that. You know, when Texas was founded, even when the United States was founded, 98% of the people were farmers or ranchers, because if you didn't grow it or kill it, you didn't eat. Today, we make up less than 2% of that. So it's imperative that we entice and encourage our young people to enter agriculture, because somebody's got to feed and clothe them in the future. The average age of the Texas farmer and rancher is about 60 years old. So we've got to have this new generation coming along.
With that being said, are there different kind of technologies that farms and ranches are using to help grow the crops, or even entice, like you said, younger students or younger kids to be more like their fathers and grandfathers and mothers and grandmothers?
Well, I explain it kind of like this. I say we're in agriculture 3.0. You know, agriculture 1.0 was 40 acres and a mule, subsistence farming. That's why 98% of the people are farmers or ranchers. There wasn't any grocery stores or anything like that. Then we went to agriculture 2.0, which is the age of mechanization. We had tractors and combines. Instead of farming 40 acres with a mule, you could farm, you know, 600 acres section of land, you know, with a tractor and a mechanical equipment. But now we've reached the technology age, which you just mentioned, where we're using drones and satellite images, and our cows are milked automatically. We don't even have to have anybody in the milking parlor, and driverless tractors. So,
Hold on a minute. You said driverless tractors? Break that down. Oh, that's very visual. I'm like, wow, I'm trying to imagine that. When do they start coming up with those, and how effective are they? That's absolutely amazing.
Not everybody uses them, but they are out there. Mm-hmm. And we've got drone unmanned spray programs by drones that are very specific and targeted. And so that allows us to use less chemical on our crops and cut our chemical uses down by 40 or 50%. And it's the technology age. We're embracing it. So farmers have come a long way. We continually have to produce more with less. That's the challenge. And we're doing that through technology.
When you were talking, and by the way, we're talking with, we're honored to have Texas Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller joining us. And Commissioner Miller, you were talking about, you know, the Farm Fresh Network, and we were talking all about the fruits and the vegetables. We didn't really touch on the beef and the poultry. And, you know, can you talk about some of the those kind of ranches and farmers that are involved with this program?
Well, we have numerous producers that produce beef and pork and lamb and chicken that are part of our Farm Fresh Network. It's not just fruits and vegetables. We have a lot of those that deliver, you know, locally grown beef. A lot of it's ground beef because it's so versatile in the cafeteria, and it's reasonable. But this is fresh, you know, locally grown, locally processed. Doesn't have additives in it. It's pure. It's lean. It's more healthy than a lot of the processed ground beef or pork that we get. And so, that's a big hit. And, you know, again, everybody wins. The producer wins, the students win, the taxpayer wins when this happens.
Okay. Here's a good personal question for you, Commissioner Miller. When you were growing up, were you in the 4-H club? Did you ever have some animals that you were raising and take them to the fair?
Sure. You know, I started out in 4-H and I got into high school, transitioned into the FFA. Mm-hmm. And I obviously had a great influence on me because I ended up being an ag teacher. It shaped my life and contributes to the job I'm doing today.
Fantastic. So if you were to say which part of the state, I'm not going to make it a debate on Central Texas, South Texas, North Texas, East Texas, or West Texas, but which area of the state actually has more produce and farms and ranches that provide the agriculture? Because I'm just kind of curious, because I've always been so impressed with the size of the state of Texas. I mean there's different parts of Texas. Like El Paso is closer to L.A. than it is to Texarkana. Texarkana is closer to St. Louis than it is to Rio Grande Valley. I'm like, this is amazing. Lubbock is closer to Denver than it is to Houston. This is a big state.
Yeah. Well, most important place in Texas, as far as it comes to agriculture, is the place where you live.
North Texas?
Maybe the Rio Grande Valley, producing ruby red grapefruits, or our winter garden area around Uvalde that produces a lot of our vegetables, or it might be the High Plains that produce the cotton that we make our clothing out of. Mm-hmm. Could be East Texas that provides our timber to build our homes and houses, or along the coast. People don't think about it, but we have a huge seafood industry.
Oh yeah,
nothing better than wild caught Texas Gulf shrimp, oysters. The most important place is the place where you're making a living in agriculture.
And I know Texas is a national leader, growing with the farm to school movement. Can you talk about how other agriculture commissioners from different states kind of talk to you about what they can do?
Well, we do. We have an organization where we meet annually or biannually and compare notes and go over what we're doing that's beneficial. And, Texas, a lot of people look up to Texas. We lead the nation in agriculture exports, cattle, cotton, wool, mohair, horses, hay, sheep, goats, honey. The list goes quite far. Actually, agriculture contributes about $300 billion annually to the Texas economy. So it's always been the glue that's helped our state together, even long before we had an oil and gas industry, going all the way back to the very first Longhorn cattle drives from South Texas to the northern railheads to supply beef to the people back east.
Speaking of the cattle drives, you like I said, we're up here in North Texas, and everybody in Fort Worth loves Cowtown and the stockyards and all the things that go on with that, and very proud of the heritage there. Can you talk about how significant Fort Worth is to Texas agriculture? Just to shout out the people in Tarrant County.
Well, Tarrant County is very important. As the fever tick problem arose and we had to stop shipping, the cattle drives kind of ended that. It only lasted about 10 years. The railroads came into Fort Worth, mm-hmm. and the Fort Worth Stockyards was home to the Swift Company and the Armor Company. And they had a huge processing. That whole from 28th Street down to Exchange was all livestock pens, and even south Exchange, the mule and horse farms.
Mm-hmm.
So for years and years, for the entire Southwest, the Stockyards was the place. It had over like 20 commission companies that bought and sold livestock there. So it's very important. And today it still is. We have a TV show called Texas Agriculture Matters that we're in weekly on 6 p.m. on RFD TV network. We're in about 55 million homes promoting Texas agriculture. And our studio is right there in the stockyards where the old livestock exchange building is. We're in the actual auction barn where they used to sell the livestock. So the stockyard is still very important to agriculture.
Commissioner Miller, I've got to ask you this as well. I mean, this is the perfect job for you because you're living it and you love what you're doing. I got to ask you, what's your favorite Texas meal? If you were to have a meal that's just all Texas, what would be on your plate?
Well, it's a pretty close almost a tie for first place. But I guess first place would be a chicken fried steak with gravy, French fries, and the jalapeno.
But
close second is a ribeye with a baked potato and maybe a glass of Merlot. So
there you go.
One for lunch and one for supper, I guess.
There you go. You know what's so funny? People who aren't familiar with chicken fried steak, different parts of the country, it's so funny. There's a friend of mine down here. He always catches them, and he'll be at a restaurant, like he'll have a buddy with his with Chicago or something, and he'll say, "Oh, I think I'll order the chicken fried steak. Give me the dark meat." And his buddy's like, "Oh, chicken! Oh. You got to know."
I guess he must want liver or something.
Exactly. It's just too funny. But back to the Farm Fresh Challenge, and expiring these. The kids and the teachers and educators in the schools and the child care centers to serve more and more Texas products. It's become a big hit, like you said, but there's even more work to be done. Can you tell people where they can find out more information and what you think, is the main thing they need to get out of this? You said it a little earlier, but it deserves to be said again.
Well, our summer feeding program is winding down, so mm-hmm. it's kind of over, but if you want to find one of those summer feeding programs, you can just dial 211 and ask them, and they'll ask your zip code, and they'll tell you, you know, how many places are in your area. We've really worked this summer to expand that to rural parts of the state. We've had it running pretty well and hit most of the urban areas, but we were lacking getting that food out to the rural areas. So that's one. I would encourage people to go to our Farm Fresh Network. There's a lot of good information on there, testimonials, how to join the network as a farmer, how to join that network as a member of the public that feeds children or adults. And there's some good testimonials on there, too, and, you know, get a lot of your questions answered there.
Absolutely love it. Again, Commissioner Miller, thank you so much for joining us. Again, for those who don't know, over 256 producers have joined the Farm Fresh Network, and it's a win-win-win. As you mentioned before, not only are the kids learning about where the food comes from, not only are they getting fed, the businesses in Texas are earning some money. And it's just everybody wins on this thing. So I appreciate you creating this program, and I thank you very much for sharing it with us today.
Well, it's good to be on your program, and I tell every new hire that comes at the Texas Department of Agriculture that we don't pick winners and losers. That's not our job. Our job is to pick winners and more winners, and that's what this program does.
Love it. Thank you again, Commissioner Miller. We're going to have you back on again real soon. Thank you.
Thank you. God bless. Appreciate you.
And joining us right now is suicide prevention advocate Fonda Bryant. With the rising number of suicides by police officers across the country, I think it's a perfect opportunity to have you on the show and discuss, which is kind of like a quiet little secret going on. Fonda, thanks again for joining us. How you doing?
Thank you for having me. Having kind of a rough day today, but I'm hanging in there.
Well, that's why we talk. Well. What do they say when you're having a rough day? Just let somebody talk, right?
Yes.
That's all a part of mental wellness, mental health. And you're all about suicide prevention. I've been talking to you on this show for years. What I did not know is that there's been a spike in law enforcement. Different law enforcement officers, police officers, are taking their own lives. Can you talk about what you've learned recently and how you've had a chance to talk to a police chief there in North Carolina?
Yes. Well, you know, a lot of people don't really take into account, Chris, what these officers see and what they do is not normal. It's not a natural thing. And anytime that they see a child killed or a child hurt, car accidents, suicides, murders, that takes a direct hit. Their brain takes a direct hit. That's trauma. Mm-hmm. And when you are dealing with trauma, it changes even the chemistry in your brain. And we had a terrible situation here on April 29th of this year, where 10 police officers were shot, 4 were killed, including a CMPD officer. And it has really taken a toll on our community, but it's also put that spotlight once again on police officers' mental health. And several weeks ago, unfortunately, last month, an 18-year veteran with CMPD, who was a dog handler, he was canine mm-hmm. officer. He went to a cemetery, which is very chilling in itself, and he hit his emergency button and took his own life.
Oh, no.
So for CMPD, Charlotte Mecklenburg Police officers, that is four department, that is 4 suicides in 2.5 years. Now, there's an organization called bluehelp.org, which keeps an eye on first responder suicides. Mm-hmm. And police officers have the most. That is the number one cause of death for police officers, not in the line of duty, but suicide is the number one cause of death for them. And I check it at least maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks, just to kind of keep myself abreast of how many are dying. And as of today, I haven't checked it, but the last time I checked last week, we've lost 54 officers nationwide to suicide. It is a problem that needs to be addressed. But just like society and stigma is the number one reason why people mm-hmm. won't go get help, it's the same thing with police officers. They don't want to go get help because they'll be looked at. They don't want to be looked at as weak, unfit for duty, crazy, or can't be trusted.
This is just an amazing stat. And again, you never think about, first responders being in that situation, but they're almost like military. Like we have certain people in the military, they go overseas, or they're in combat situations, and some of them that when they come back, they're dealing with stress, and some of them wind up taking their lives if they're not able to handle it. Can you compare those situations a little bit and tell us some more what you have found out of what causes all of this? Like you said, they're not necessarily prepared for it. And we're going to talk about some of your solutions in just a minute. But tell us about some of the things you've learned so far and compare it to soldiers in the military.
Well, you know something, one of the things that I've stressed, and I know it's probably never going to change, Chris, but I don't think a police, when you come from the military, especially if you've seen combat, I do not think that you should automatically become a police officer. I think there should be a cooling off period between 6 months and a year before you put that police officer uniform on, because what you're doing is you're coming from trauma. And then you're going to put more trauma on top of it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that police officers coming straight from the military is a good idea, period, because these officers, you know, I don't get too preachy when I'm talking to these police officers, but they trust me and they know that I understand what they're dealing with. Even though I'm not an officer, they still know I understand. And one of the things that I tell them is God didn't intend us to go to war. He didn't intend us to be violent to one another. He intended us to live in peace. So what they see and what they do is not natural. You know, a couple of years ago, right before Christmas, this is one of the ones that really, really got to me. And I'm going to tell you, if I'd have been a police officer on the scene that day, I would have quit. So they had this 18-year-old male here in Charlotte that had just got out of a mental health facility. He went up to a high-rise apartment building uptown Charlotte. I don't know if he lived there or not. Went up to the rooftop, jumped 36 stories, and fell beside a police officer. If that had been me, that would have been the last day me working as a CMPD police officer. I do not know how they do it. But the psychologist that used to work for them and quit, she got so many calls, Chris, when she went on vacation, over 200 emails and voicemails from CMPD officers needing help, and they didn't get her help. She quit. So she had told me this stat that just knocked me over, but it's really not surprising. She said 2 years out of the academy, 2 years after officers, police officers leave the academy, 45% of them turn to substance abuse. 5 years out of the academy, 85% of officers turn to substance abuse. So that lets you know right there, we got a lot of officers out here who are self-medicating instead of getting the help they need. And see, when they do that, they become a danger to the public and they become a danger to themselves. And when I'm training rookie officers, the first thing I tell them is, listen, guys, we do not need y'all out here if y'all are not taking care of your mental health. Look what just happened in Illinois with a police officer. He got a dishonorable discharge. He had got caught twice DUI. Those were red flags everywhere. Mm-hmm. He shouldn't have been a police officer. And if they caught that, they said he had been at 6 police departments in 4 years. He should have been getting help. And if he wouldn't get the help, he should have been gone. And that young lady probably would still be here today.
Yeah. This is so tragic. It's almost like a vicious cycle. Are there police departments or law enforcement officials where they can seek some kind of training, whether it's the QPR training, which is the question, persuade, refer that you're all about? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, you know, solutions to some of this, because again, a lot of them internalize all this because they don't want to seem to be weak. They don't want to seem to be not strong, and they definitely don't want to lose their job.
Definitely. And they also fear about getting a promotion. But an officer told me this a couple of weeks ago. I was at the government center uptown Charlotte. And she told me, she said, if
getting help for mental health shouldn't be as hard as it is. Mindful Therapy Group is here to make your mental health journey as painless as possible. Mindful partners with thousands of licensed clinicians to find the perfect fit for you. And also accepts insurance. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com.
It's better over here. Now at T-Mobile, get 4 5G phones on us and 4 lines for $25 a line per month when you switch with eligible trade-ins. All on America's largest 5G network.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees and $10 device connection charge. Phones via 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. Bill credits end if you pay off devices early. See T-Mobile.com.
if you have a suicide attempt, your career is done. Your career is done. Now, Charlotte, CMPD and Chief Jennings and Deputy Chief Chicory, they have put together a wellness team specifically to help police officers with CMPD. But guess what these officers tell me? Oh, no, I'm not going to use that, because they're so worried that if they go get help, they don't even like where it's located. It's not located in the main building where the headquarters is for CMPD. Mm-hmm. It's located in another police division. But they don't even want to go because they've told me, hey, if I go in there, people are going to know what I'm in there for.
Right. And then they see you walking out and they'll have a stigma attached to you.
Yes. So it needs to be where they can go somewhere private. But again, they don't even trust it, because I tell the rookies, use your EAP, your employee assistance program, that helps with grief, marital issues, finances, mental health, an array of things. And I say, y'all use your EAP. They will send you a list of providers to your email. Private, you can go and see a therapist. The veteran officers, they don't even want to do that, because even though they're bound by HIPAA, these therapists, they can't say a word. These officers are terrified that it will still get back to their superior officers and they will know, hey, this person went to go see a therapist. And then they're worried about, hey, you're going to look at me as weak. I can't handle the assignment. I'm never going to get promoted. We have got to change that mentality that going to get help is a sign of weakness. So you'd rather not go get help, but you'd rather self-medicate. You'd rather have domestic violence. You'd rather have all these other issues, these anger issues, than going to get the help and being the best officer you can be. But you'd rather just hide behind, I'm fine, and not go get the help and put the public in danger.
It's a very troubling situation, because again, it's like, it's underneath the radar and it could happen at any time. And some of the situations, you know, they don't make sense until you do the profile check and say, wait a minute, he was actually needing some help, or she was actually needing some help, but she didn't know where to go. I bring this up also because former Dallas police chief David Brown, who got national acclaim after the parade shooting here in Dallas back in 2016, where he handled that situation almost flawlessly. One of the things he was saying at one of his press conferences afterwards, there's a lot of pressure on police officers because people expect more of them what they are. And he was given the example of, you know, they respond to a call, and the people who call them expect them to be, you know, a mediator. They expect them to be a teacher. They expect them to be, you know, all these things other than a police officer or a law enforcement officer. And they don't know what's what, who's who, until they get to the scene of the incident. And then again, they're put in the middle of a lot of situations that aren't mm-hmm. quite fair for them. And then when they're off duty, they got to take that home.
Yes. And that's the thing. You know, I did an analogy with Chief Jennings last week, our chief here in Charlotte. And I told him, I said, I have officers to visualize a plate. And I said, you put all this food on the plate and then you keep putting more food on the plate. And that's what society expects from police officers. They want them to do everything they want them to handle every situation that is going on in this country that is bad. And not saying necessarily that mental health is bad, but as big an advocate as I am for CIT, the Crisis Intervention Team police officers, because 29 years ago when I was taken to a mental health facility, we didn't have CIT officers. Mm-hmm. And we know that people have been killed with mental health issues, that the officers were not trained in how to help.
Right.
So it's a great entity. It's a great entity. But see, Chris, at the end of the day, police officers shouldn't be helping us with mental health issues, addiction, or suicide. We are a lazy society. We don't want to take any responsibility. We want to put everything on the police. If society did a better job with early detection, caring, getting rid of the stigma, better and more resources and education like QPR training, mm-hmm. we would not need police officers. You know, we keep putting all these societal issues on them and then they're struggling. And then you expect them to go, okay, I went, and like I said, an officer saw a man jump 36 stories to his death and fell right beside him. And then people think, oh, okay, they just clear the call and go back to work. That's not normal.
No.
That is not natural. And so I can understand them turning to substance abuse. Because let's face it, Chris, when you watch like some of my favorite shows are Law & Order, SVU, mm-hmm. I like those shows. Mm-hmm. Where do they always show police officers going to blow off steam?
Bar. Go to the bar.
Go to the bars. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So we got to help them to find a better way. And that's why I truly, truly appreciate being able to start with the rookies, being able to train them. And I'm going to tell you something funny about them. Years ago, I started working with the rookies when Chief Putney was in office. And I think that was like 2018 or 2019. And at first, I just went and spoke to them about mental health, suicide prevention. They wouldn't say a word. They wouldn't say a word, but you could look in their eyes and see some of them really wanted to open up. But because of that stigma,
and
they
peer pressure right there in the room.
Oh, no, they weren't going to say a word. But now you fast forward to the last 2 years. I have been, well, first off, I've been with them a long time. I went from speaking by myself to being part of the community engagement team for CMPD. But now, since I've been training them, I've done four classes, the 193rd, 194th, 195th. 196. I will be training the 197th on September 11th. And then the last class for this year graduating, I will be training them in November. Chris, they become chatty patties about their mental health. And it makes me so proud.
Good.
I'm so proud of them. And then I always ask them, what do they do for self-care? And I never will forget one of the rookie officers told me, he said, Ms. Fonda, he said, the reason why I wanted to be a police officer was because I came through trauma. It was domestic violence. It was drug abuse. He said, I want to help people like me when I was a kid. So I said, okay, what do you do for self-care? He said, I take bubble baths with candles around the tub. I said, it's nothing wrong with that. I said, good for you. Then I had another rookie. He was just 21 years old. And when he graduated last year, he said, Ms. Fonda, I'm going to show you what I do for self-care. And I said, what do you do, young man? We walked out to the car. He went to his car and got a tub of chocolate chip cookies. He said, I bake. He said, I bake. So these officers, these rookies,
whatever works.
They got it. They're seeing now this job is no joke.
Yeah.
And if I don't put my mental health first, I am not going to be any good to myself. And I'm sure not going to be any good to the public. Because, Chris, I'm going to tell you, on days when my depression is kicking my butt, I don't want you speaking to me, talking to me until I get myself together. Now, put on a gun and a uniform and you stop somebody on a routine traffic stop and they say something smart to you or you say something smart.
Yeah.
And then next thing you know, it's escalated and somebody's hurt or dead.
Again, that's what a lot of people don't understand. And I think what you said earlier, for those who missed it, suicide is the number one cause of death of police officers, not being in the line of duty. Suicide, not any situation in the line of duty. And that's why, like I said, it's kind of like, you know, America's little secret. It's like you've got to be aware and there's got to be some there's got to be some ways that we can resolve and solve some of these stresses on our police officers because we need them.
We definitely do. We need them. And I'm going to tell you something else that we need to do. We need to be thinking about their families.
Yes.
Because I'm sure when that happened on the 29th, because one of my rookie classes that I had a young lady, and I always go to the graduation. And I'm going to tell you something, Chris. Mm-hmm. That graduation that they do through CMPD, I'm not sure how they do it with other police departments. It is so touching and it just moves you because they call all their names to get their certificate and then they go down off the stage and they're all kind of circling down at the bottom and then they do the oath and the oath is very touching in itself and then they tell them they can reach in their pockets and put their badges on. And I'm telling you, it is a very touching moment because a lot of them truly, truly want to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
So then after the graduation, I always start talking to the families. And I'm going to tell you something, we forget about them because when that happened on the 29th, I'm sure it was family members like, man, can you find another job? Can you do something else? Because two of the rookies, there were 10 of my rookies from the 196th class that had just graduated on April 19th. Then they went to work on the 23rd, and then that tragedy happened on the 29th. 10 rookies were there. Two of them already quit, And that trauma will be with them no matter what they do in life. And I'm hoping they get the help. But you imagine the toll it takes on their family, too. And that's another thing. I've been wanting to get QPR training for family members because a lot of them don't know what to do. They're scared.
Right.
Some of them, officers have kids that are small. They don't understand that. They just know every time mommy or daddy puts that badge on and goes out, there's a chance they might not come home. So it takes a toll. It's a domino effect, not just on the officers and the community, but their families, their children, their parents. They have families and children, too, that they want to go home to. And every day they put that uniform on. It's like I always say, it's not really a uniform. It is a it's a uniform, but it's a uniform of depression, anxiety, fear, hate, anger, post-traumatic stress, and trauma. That's what they put on every single day.
We're talking.
I don't know how they do it.
I don't know how they. It's an amazing thing. And again, sometimes it's, they're taken for granted because, oh, they're the police. They have already been trained and they should. There's more to this. They're human beings first. We're talking with suicide prevention advocate Fonda Bryant. And you've talked about QPR, suicide prevention training, on this show before. Can you tell those who are just hearing about it for the first time what is involved with question, persuade, and refer QPR suicide prevention training? Because you are the person with the knowledge.
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, I'm going to tell you, I'm so proud to be a QPR question, persuade, refer suicide prevention instructor. I always ask people when I train, how many of y'all have been CPR trained? And a lot of people raise their hand and I say, y'all, CPR and QPR are basically the same. CPR is to help somebody having a physical crisis, and mental health is a physical crisis as well. You administer the CPR, and whether somebody's having a heart attack or stroke on the way to the hospital, they still may die or they might die later on. And I always ask people, is that your fault if they don't live? No, because you did everything on the front end to help them. Mm-hmm. Same thing with QPR. You can save someone's life and we can still die by suicide. And I tell everybody that is not your fault, because guess what? We got to want to live. We have to put in the work every single day. I'm a 29-year veteran of suicide. I have to put in the work every single day, watch what I do, draw those boundaries, make sure I take care of myself, because if not, I run that risk of dying by suicide, and I don't want that. So QPR is basically four things, and it really gives you spider sense. You will listen more intently. You will look at how people are acting. Number one, it helps you to recognize the signs of someone in crisis or suicidal. Number two, it helps you gauge your mental health. How am I doing today? Maybe I need to go talk to someone. And that's so important for the police officers that I train. Number three, if you pick up on those warning signs early enough, you can keep somebody from going into crisis or becoming suicidal. And the fourth thing that it does, it gives you that confidence to leap into action like a superhero, like my Aunt Spanky did for me 29 years ago. My motto with QPR training is become someone's hero, because anyone can save someone's life, from a youth to an adult. Anyone can save someone's life by recognizing those signs, getting educated, knowing what to say, knowing what to do. Anyone can save a life. Suicide is the most preventable death of all deaths, but yet it is a global health crisis, not a personal character flaw.
What did you say? Worldwide, every 40 seconds, every 40 seconds, someone dies by suicide.
Every 40 seconds. By the time 12 o'clock hits tonight, over 2,000 people. And mind you, these stats I'm saying, they're underreported, because suicide stats, these are people, by the way, but these stats are worse than what I'm saying, because suicide is underreported. So by the time 12 o'clock hits tonight, 2,000 people worldwide would have died by suicide, and over 50,000 would have attempted.
Fonda, the work you do is just absolutely amazing. And I want to just shift gears for a second, because this is also deserves a little bit of attention, not as much as suicide prevention, but it does deserve some attention. You and I have been talking for a couple of years now, and you have a Dallas connection. In fact, your father is the late, great soul singer, Johnny Taylor, Dallas's own Johnny Taylor, who had like multiple gold records, the first ever platinum record with Disco Lady. Everybody remembers his big hit, Who's Making Love? And he passed away a few years ago. And I think there's a book out now, and he's going to get a star on the Hollywood Boulevard, possibly. What's the latest on this? Because we've got to take it a little local. There's a lot of people who listen to this show. They grew up being Johnny Taylor fans and caught him performing here in Dallas.
Yeah, we've had an exciting year so far. You know, my father died in 2000, May 31st of 2000, and we went through a terrible, ugly, painful court battle to be declared heirs. And one of the
things like Prince and his family.
Oh yeah,
it sounded definitely like the was. Same thing.
Yeah, so it was a rough go, but you know, I've been able to forgive my father for not being a father to me because mm-hmm. of the work that I do. This work is so rewarding, and it also opens your eyes to be able to forgive people, because my father dealt with his own issues with self-medicating, and I truly know my father dealt with some mental health disorder. I just don't know what it was. But anyway, my father, I flew to Memphis in May. My father got a brass music note on Beale Street. It should be down now. Matter of fact, I need to follow up. John Horniak, who is executive director for the Memphis Grammys, he has nominated my father for the Lifetime Achievement Award with the Grammys, and he has also nominated some of his music, including Disco Lady, the first ever platinum record certified by the RIAA, for the Grammy Hall of Fame. Now, I did some homework on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and we missed the deadline this year, but God willing, next year, I will be nominating my father for a Hollywood star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. We're still pushing for him. It's been 31 years, Chris. He is still hadn't even been nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but we're just going to keep pushing because he deserves so many accolades. And this is how I'm able to do this work, because he was a deadbeat dad. He did not take care of me, but you have to separate. And this is what I tell people all the time. I don't get caught up with entertainers, because if you separate the entertainer from the person, a lot of time the person is going to let you down. Mm-hmm. I will never take away my father's talent and the fact that he was a great entertainer. But on the father's side, he was none of that. He was not a great father. He did not take care of me. But again, I'm always going to fight for him to get the accolades in the entertainment industry, because he deserved it. And this book that just came out, I Believe in You, I think it's going to give people a glimpse into his life. But I just want people to always know we shouldn't make excuses or dismiss people because they were famous for not taking care of their children and not doing what was right.
You're exactly right, because not everybody is that total person that you can admire. But, you know, some of the greatest people in the world, in whatever field endeavor they're in, they're flawed. They have certain flaws. And Johnny Taylor was one of those people, but he was also, like you said, an amazing musician, a great singer. You mentioned Memphis because that was the home of Stax Records, the legendary Stax Records, where he recorded. And he was on the same record label with Isaac Hayes and Rufus Thomas and the Staple Singers, and going on and on and on. Al Green's from Memphis. So when you think of some of the greatest music out of Memphis, even though he was from Dallas and he spent he lived here in Dallas the whole nine yards, performed in Dallas all over the country and all over the world. Yes, he definitely should be acknowledged. And I think you're right. He should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, like some of the other great musicians of all time.
Definitely. And, you know, something that I learned from, you know, this year, they had a 4-part documentary on HBO about Stax. And Stax was loaded, like you said. My father was the first signee to Sam Cooke's record label.
Sam and Dave.
You're talking about Sam and Dave. Otis Redding.
Yeah, Otis Redding.
But you know what was really interesting, Chris? Do you know that my father outsold Otis Redding? He was the number one selling artist at Stax.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. That's really something.
Yeah.
And the thing is, my father and Otis Redding were really tight. And I did get a chance to ask somebody who worked at Stax. I said, what did my father think about Otis Redding passing away? Because my father was one of his pallbearers, and mm-hmm. he also sang at his funeral. And he said, Otis shouldn't have bought that plane. He should have never bought that plane.
Yeah,
so
the famous
my
crash.
Father, like I said, he deserves the accolades that he gets. And even before Disco Lady was the first ever platinum record certified by the RIAA, Who's Making Love to Your Old Lady sold 2 million copies. And I always tell these young people, see, you can sell millions a lot faster now because of streaming and all these other downloading and all of this. I said, but back in the day, guys, for Disco Lady and Who's Making Love, you had to get up off the sofa
and go to the record store
and buy it.
Yeah.
See, these young people don't know nothing like about
that. Yeah, you had to physically get up and go to the store, Sound Music, Sound Warehouse, wherever it was. Capitol Records, wherever it was, you got to go physically get the albums and the records, and he was quite the giant in the music industry. Before we let you get out of here, school is about to start up again, and is there some advice, because a lot of people kind of take it for granted that there is a high rate of suicide, and people should be aware of mental health awareness for kids in school, especially those who are off in college and those kind of peer pressures with high school and college age kids.
Yes, sir. I appreciate this conversation so much. So this is for you, parents. The second leading cause of death for young people, 10 to 24, is suicide. It is the second leading cause of death on college campuses, with over 24,000 college students attempting suicide every year. So this is what I've been really telling parents. Listen to your children without judgment, because if they can't come and talk to you about the small stuff, they're not going to come and talk to you about the big things. And that goes for your kids in college. Mm-hmm. When I go up to football games or I'm speaking to college students, a lot of them are terrified to call home if things aren't going well in college because they feel like their parents are going to jump all over them. So I tell you this, parents, they're not grown in college. Our kids are going to need us for the rest of our lives. So listen to your children without judgment. Hear what they're saying and just be willing to get them help. Be there. Because if you put that there, hey, I'm here for anything, they will come to you and tell you what's going on. And this was really shocking, Chris, that just came out last week. 13 to 17 year old youth have the highest call in to 988. 13 to 17,
oh, wow.
Over 6,500. 13 to 16 year olds are calling 988. So you know what that lets me know? Parents aren't listening to their kids. They feel like they have no one to talk to, so they're calling 988. So parents, again, listen to your children, hear what they're saying, and don't be judgmental. If they come to you and they're struggling, be willing to go and get them help. But the first line of communication should be parents listening without judgment. And if they come and tell you, hey, mom, dad, I think I'm dealing with anxiety, I'm dealing with depression, don't hesitate to get them help, because the stats say by the time a child is 14, 50% of them are already dealing with a mental health condition. By the time they're 24, it's 75%. And if they don't go get help, we see this all the time at the high school level, and teachers have told me at the middle school level, 50% of them turn to substance abuse. 50%.
50%.
So parents, half. Not beat you up, but please listen to your kids without judgment and be willing to get them help if they need it.
And part of this is it's the world today. I mean, social media, all the different platforms, peer pressure, bullying, trolls, bots. I mean, there's all kind of things that a lot of us never grew up with that are happening with the kids, Gen Z, and I guess the latest level is Gen A. They're dealing with things on levels that we never even imagined.
Definitely. And, you know, one of the biggest things now the FBI has been reporting is sextortion. Where kids, and this is why I tell these young people, I really talk to them like they're my children, because I've been doing QPR training at a university, Johnson C. Smith University. And I've been telling them, guys, do not send pictures of yourself. I don't care if it's your boyfriend, girlfriend,
exactly.
Partner.
Nope.
Do not send explicit pictures of yourself, and do not get online. I said, because y'all have no idea who you're talking to. And all you got to do is send one explicit picture and it can ruin your life. And do you know, Chris, we're having an increase of suicide because because of sextortion. So I tell parents, have these conversations. See, it used to be, Chris, I was born in 1960. You could wait for a while and have some of these conversations. You can't wait anymore because social media has speeded everything up.
Yeah.
And predators are hoping and praying parents don't have these conversations with their children. So parents, it goes back again, listening without judgment, hearing what they're saying, because social media, as one of my dear friends calls it, the devil. And it's really taking a toll on our kids' mental health.
It really has. And you mentioned sextortion. It's not even just people that they don't know that they are contacting and sending pictures out. It could be a relationship that they broke up with. Whoever's
exactly.
on the other end of that relationship can threaten them with those mm-hmm. kind of comments and make their lives just murderous. I mean, terrible. It's like it's just very stressful. And like you said, it can lead to suicide.
Definitely, it can, because like I tell the students too, I said, guys, once it gets out there on the World Wide Web, even though now it's become law that if you send a picture of somebody explicit, you can get in a lot of trouble.
Yep.
The damage is already done.
Uh-huh.
It can destroy you getting into college. It can destroy you getting a job. And again, do you know, Chris, on the CBS Morning News, they talked about how they have 9 and 10 year olds stealing money out of their parents' wallets and purses to try to pay sextortionists.
Wow.
That's how bad it's gotten. So again, parents, we're parents. Do your job. Check on your kids. Watch what they're doing. Listen to your kids without judgment. And if they come to you about something, don't dismiss and say, oh, you young, you don't know what you're talking about. Listen to what they're saying, because I'm going to tell you something, Miss Fonda, when I go and speak at schools, I get slammed by students wanting to talk to me. And and even though I appreciate them coming to me, I shouldn't be the one that they're talking to. It should be their parents.
Fonda, you are a total wealth of information. We cannot thank you again for joining us. And we want to thank everyone for listening to us on Better Living, a show about people or organizations having a big impact here in North Texas. I'm your host, Chris Arnold. So long, everybody.
Struggling with mental health shouldn't be the norm. At Mindful Therapy Group, we specialize in connecting you with compassionate therapists to find the perfect fit for you. Mindful Therapy Group accepts most health insurances. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com to start your mental health journey today.
It's better over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90+ days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.